This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, and all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net.
911, what are you reporting?
We got someone or something crawling around out here.
Did you see what it was? Was it a person or an animal? Or
I can't tell. All I know is that my sensor light came on, and I just happened to glimpse and see this thing running across the yard. A good-sized man or something that looks like a man. I don't know what it was, just that it ran across the yard. Whatever it is, it's running. I couldn't catch it if I was going to chase it. Jesus Christ, you better...
Sir?
See ya.
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Is he in your yard, sir?
Yeah, God, he's big.
Okay, what's he doing in your yard?
He's looking at me.
Okay. And the guy is on foot?
It's a big, real big person, that's all I can say.
Okay, but it is a person.
Yeah, I'd say it was a person or somebody really big, but he's all in black.
Is he a black male or a white male? Did you actually see whether, or was he just wearing black?
He's all black and he's big. He is big.
Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. This is Strange Harbor.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird.
The strange, the unabashed, the uncontrolled, the unleashed.
The unleashed, unleash us. It's Johnny and Billy, and we talk weird topics. Well, I guess the definition of weird. I hate to say, like, weird and strange, because, I don't know, to you and I don't think these things are strange.
Well, they're just on the far side of normal. They're called paranormal because they don't fall 100% within the range of normal.
Okay.
We should talk about that one day, about what's normal and what's abnormal and what's paranormal and what all these things mean.
Normal or typical or common?
There's a range of normalcy, and it's what's acceptable by society. 150 years ago, people walked around in little western towns and they carried guns and they drank whiskey and played poker, and at the same time they were trying to live normal lives. They were farmers and ranchers and business people that were just trying to live a good life. Sometimes, if they had an argument, they would have a gunfight to resolve the argument. That was within a socially accepted norm or a normal thing. But today, if we did all of that stuff, that would not be within the socially accepted norms. The more civilized we become, the more change and the more controlled, I guess. I hate to use that word too, but the more we change our definition of normal. And that definition fluctuates, and it's not just one behavior, but it's a whole range of behaviors that fall within normal. Having worked in the mental health field, when you diagnose someone with a mental illness, it's because that behavior or thought process interrupts their ability to be socially functional. If you're just a little weird, you still fall within the bounds of normalcy, but you're over on the edge. You know, you're not right down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still within the bounds of what's socially acceptable as normal. So, and we don't become disordered until we fall outside of that boundary. So social and occupational functioning are the primary things we look at in diagnosing people with a mental illness.
Easy.
So if their behavior affects their social and occupational functioning, you know, their ability to relate to other people, to work, to go to school, to do all of that, then they're disordered. They fall outside the realm of normal behavior. So it's kind of like you and I.
Isn't there an organization called NORML? It's N-O-R-M-L, National Organization for the Re-Legalization of Marijuana, something.
I don't know. I've never heard of them. But
I was in a band called Fine Silver Thread, and we had a song called Normal Guy, and it had to do with that. But anyway.
So you know, last week we had a very interesting guest.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Ronnie Dumont. He talked about symbolism and the Illuminati. And he had a video, which I watched recently.
So you watched it?
I watched it, yeah. The Find Muck
yeah.
video. And it's interesting. It's a little over an hour long.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about a lot of things. I mean, in that short period of time, he crams a lot of information in there. Some of this, you know, when we talk about secret societies.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they're not secret because we know about them. So,
well, yeah, because people can't keep secrets, remember?
That's true, and that's why, you know, I have issues with conspiracy theories, because conspiracies require, in order to be successful, require a certain level of secrecy, and people have a hard time keeping secrets. So they have a hard time maintaining conspiracies. And the bigger the group, the harder it is to maintain. You know, it's like the fake moon thing. Well, you know, there were, at the time, working for NASA, just in the organization of NASA, and this isn't the people that built the spaceships or anything else, there's 400,000 people
mm-hmm.
working on this project. How do you keep 400,000 people, or get 400,000 people to keep a secret?
Well, you know, they're all getting paid.
Well, it's true.
They're all getting paid to keep their mouths shut. If it's paying my bills...
But they don't get paid that much to keep their mouths shut and to deceive the public. They have integrity.
Well, maybe they're convinced that it's in the best interest of society that... Maybe they were brainwashed, another conspiracy. They were brainwashed by those... I forget the name, the term, but pretty much they're just brainwashed.
And see, now you're talking outside the realm of normalcy. Brainwashing, it does work. I mean, but it doesn't work
yeah,
for
everybody.
Yeah,
that's what psychiatrists and therapists do.
I'm teasing. Not exactly, but kind of, in a way.
Okay.
You know, we can... One of the military does something very interesting. When you go through military training, if you've ever been in the military, you would know about this. We have kind of a moral dilemma when it comes to the military. So in order to change that, it would take a year or more, maybe even years of therapy to change that. So the military doesn't focus on changing your behavior. What they focus on is changing your philosophy. Because when you change your philosophy, your behavior changes with you. So by changing your philosophy, by doing a couple of different things, the first thing they do is dehumanize the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
We call them names. Okay, this is what political parties do, too.
Mm-hmm.
They dehumanize the opponent by calling them names. So that immediately takes them out of being real live human beings with mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles that all went to school and learned read and write and arithmetic and all the other things. I mean, they're just normal people. If you're shooting somebody that doesn't appear human, it's much easier to point a gun and pull the trigger than if you see somebody...
There's a father of five! Shoot him!
Yeah, that's a father of five or somebody's brother or mm-hmm. aunt or uncle or mom or dad. If we think about it in those terms, you're going to have a much harder time shooting at somebody. There comes a point, of course, where self-preservation kicks in and you fight back. We had people that were conscientious objectors and came to the war and said, you know, I'll be in your war, I'll participate in your war, but I won't shoot anybody. I know we had a guy that came to our unit, and he said, well, I'm not going to carry a gun because I'm a conscientious objector and I refuse to shoot people and participate in the killing and the violence of the war. So we went out, and he marched out there with all the rest of us without any weapons or at all. Probably within an hour after leaving the base camp, we got hit hard. I mean, we got hit really hard. We walked right into an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
We had people dying left and right. People were being wounded. We couldn't get the dead and the wounded out fast enough. it was very, very frightening. I mean, you know, when you're in that situation, it's extraordinarily frightening. Well, the very next day, this young man who didn't want to fight, I don't think he had any food in his pack. I think he had just ammunition and guns.
No.
And
he changed his tune, did he?
Very quickly, yes. Not that that's a good thing. I think we need to be critical. We need to oppose things. But sometimes self-preservation kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
And we do something we don't want to do or we don't like to do just to preserve our own skin, basically. Which is kind of what you were saying about how the conspiracy theory works, is that people are protecting their own interests by keeping quiet. The question is, out of the 400,000 people that work on the space program, statistically, you would think that at least 1% of them would have enough integrity to step forth and say something if this was a hoax. Because there's always about 1% of any population, of any group, is not willing to buy into a conspiracy. The bigger the group, the more people you have that aren't buying in and that are thinking critically. And therefore, you are likely to have the truth come out if there is a deception. Now, if there's no deception, the reality will remain.
Maybe that's how the conspiracy came out, was people there talking.
Said that it was a hoax, but the people that worked on it are not coming out and saying it was a hoax.
Well, but maybe that's how that happened. The people that were working on it came out and said to somebody, hey, you know what, this is all BS.
Or what if somebody from the outside decided to discredit it and get people to think in a different direction, in the direction they want, and created this deception out of basically nothing?
What if monkeys flew out of my butt?
Then we call you monkey butt.
Monkey butt.
So the point I'm trying to make is, having worked in government, there's a lot of different people. There's a lot of different perspectives on what's happening. It was so difficult basically pull off any kind of deception, because there were always people that would say, you know, hey, this is not right. And I don't think it's about losing a job, because it's so hard to lose a government job. I mean, it is. You either have to commit a violent crime, or you have to be so immoral that they can no longer tolerate
it. Okay, how about this? I'm working this government job, and I spill the beans, and they silence me by removing me from my job and my existence and just off me. You've heard conspiracy theories about, you know, oh, he supposedly jumped off the 10th floor of the hospital kind of thing. But does that make sense?
If there were just one person. If you're talking 1% of 400,000 people that would have the integrity to stand up and wouldn't be afraid of losing their job or any kind of repercussions, you're talking about hundreds of people. They can't just disappear, hundreds of people. Again, somebody asking questions, and those that are remaining are more likely to rebel once you start doing things that are unconscionable, that are socially unacceptable. It's harder and harder to get people to go along.
I still think brainwashing works.
It does. It works well. You know, the Hitler did it in World War II, or in Nazi Germany in the 30s. You know, he slowly got people to believe a certain way, to change their philosophy, by telling them that a certain group of people were bad and that all the problems the German people were experiencing were due to this group of people. So, you know, our political parties do exactly the same thing. They demonize the opposing party, and they demonize groups of people, blacks, Jews, Mexicans.
Bald guys.
And every time we demonize any group of people, we think that somehow they're the source of our problems. But in reality, the source of our problems is us. We are the source of our own problems.
Mm-hmm.
We're human beings. We have free will. Anything that happens to us is generally brought on by our own behavior. Not always. I mean, that sometimes, you know, stuff happens that we have no control over. But it's usually pretty rare. If you look back at all the events that lead up to an incident, you find that people had the ability to change the course of that incident before it happened. But they don't see it because they're so busy looking at someone else as the source of problem. They never look at themselves.
So we're going to have Ronnie Dumont back on the show, and we're going to grill him, right? We're going to grill him with questions.
Yeah.
Where were you on September 11th, pal?
Well, I think he has the answers, too.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is smart. He's well-organized. Unfortunately, when you put together a video like he did, you know, your time is limited.
Yeah.
Your ability to present. And I think he presented a lot of stuff in that video. What I would like to do is have him break some of that down,
mm-hmm.
and talk about his research, how he researched all these different things, and maybe just talk about something like the Eye of Ra. I think you could mm-hmm. talk about that. You could present information about that, its history and what it means and where it goes and who's using it. I think you could talk about that for an hour or more.
Mm-hmm.
Easily. Any one of the concepts that he put forth could probably be expanded. So I think he started with a good mind tickler.
Tickle, tickle.
Yes. Or fine muck.
And, yeah.
I'd like to hear more. I mean, I'd like to hear more about individual issues rather than all of those issues. The pyramid is mm-hmm. another thing that's very prevalent in our society, and people believe that pyramids have a great power to channel energy. The question is, where do they get that idea? I think that we need to talk to him about some of the more details, and I think he has the answers.
I saw, I don't know if it was a documentary, what it was, but they were pretty much insinuating, or they're speculating, that the pyramids provided power to the city. I don't remember exactly the entire concept, but somehow it was like the epicenter. It was like the PUD. It just provided power to the surrounding areas.
Right. I've heard that. And when they talk about that story, they've got some pretty compelling evidence.
Mm-hmm. So I'll try to find it. And if you will, too, you look, and I'll look and see what we come up with.
All right.
We're both in trouble. We're all in trouble.
We're all in trouble. So Johnny, you know, what else is new on the strange front?
There's always UFO sightings.
Of course.
It seems like just daily, all over the world, UFO sightings. It seems like more and more they're orbs. And even daytime, orby ones, not just I saw metallic aircraft
right.
hovering. It's just I saw this beam of light or this orb, this orange ball of light. Why do you think it seems nowadays it's more orby than it used to be?
Rather than saucery.
Saucery, yeah. Not sorcery.
Saucery.
Saucery.
And then also there's the triangular shape. Crafts
mm-hmm.
that we've heard about, and there's some actual photographs of, not very good ones, but but again, you know, lately, I don't know if it's just that I've been thinking about it more, but I've seen more things in the sky that I can't really explain. Just lights that seem too bright to be a planet.
Mm-hmm.
Although the planet Mars is very prominent in the sky right now.
Yeah.
So, you may see that and think it's a UFO or something, but I think we should probably maybe talk to Bill Puckett again about how do you determine what is a UFO and what isn't? Is there a way to watch these lights and make some determination about what it is, whether it's a UFO or maybe something else?
There is a daytime photo on Bill Puckett's site, UFOs Northwest, that's UFOSNW.com. Bright orange light hovers southern sky. This was in Baker City, Oregon, just last week. Not even last week. It was this week. There's a photo right there. It was 30 minutes before sunrise. It's still light out and posted right there on the front page. Polson, Montana, last week. Photo and enlarge of a bright object seen by witness. Boom, there it is. Two orb-like objects, suddenly oblong and dome-like bubbles, Skyway, Washington. That was a couple weeks ago. the picture on Mr. Puckett's site is the sketch of what they saw.
Yeah.
Still. Slow-moving orange object flies into clouds a couple weeks ago, and they got a picture of that. Unknown rectangular object found in background of photo. It's kind of a weird object when you go to his website and see photo of strange object seen in sky. This was in Virginia a few weeks ago. By the photo, it could be anything.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, see, this is why we need more education, personal education, I think, on UFOs, so that they're more readily recognizable.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can look at something, make a conscious choice about, you know, whether it's something else or whether it's a UFO.
Let's see. Glowing orange lights move rapidly in the sky. They get photo enlarged. A video, blinking orange orb with starburst shake. That was the first week of July. So how do you determine if, okay, it's around the 4th of July... You know, is that one of those Chinese lanterns or whatever floating around, left over, or fireworks?
Sure. And that's a good question. I mean, how do you determine if you're looking at something, how do you determine whether or not it's a Chinese lantern? And for those that don't know what Chinese lanterns are, they're essentially a paper bag with a small candle suspended below it. And the heat from the candle goes up into the bag and lights it up and allows it to float through the air like a hot air balloon. So they rise in the air. When they're up high and they're moving, they do look like UFOs.
Two orange lights followed by two more. Ocean Park, Washington, 4th of July. And there's photos. But I've noticed orange, orange, giant orange, glowing orange, orange, orange object, bright orange light. Why are they orange?
Good question. The question is, are they orange or are they white, but they are discolored by our atmosphere? The more pollution in the atmosphere, the more orange color we get. That's why we get orange and pink and red sunsets, simply because it's the elements in our atmosphere that create that.
Okay.
Moisture, minerals, and pollutants, other things that can cause those colors.
So you're speculating it's our atmosphere that's making them appear orange to us.
I think so. I think that maybe they are orange.
Yeah.
But if they were white and they were quite far away, by the time that light reached us, the light would look more orange after it travels through the atmosphere.
And the smog and the crap and the ozone or lack of ozone.
And then the more polluted your atmosphere is, like if you live in Los Angeles, the more orange.
Yeah, they wouldn't even see him in Los Angeles, would they?
But, you know, that's just my speculation about why they're orange.
Oh, that's a bunch of New Age hooey.
I know. I'm just a New Age hooey-er.
Well, at Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, and coming up, what do you want to talk about?
Let's talk about something
strange. Something strange.
Something strange and unusual.
You're listening to Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor, be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. Hey, and if you have any weird topics you want us to discuss, just log on to strangeharbor.net, use the little contact form there, and let us know if there's something out there you think we should investigate or just a topic you think we need to bring up here on the show. What do you think, Bill?
Well, I think that's a good idea. If you have something, you know, we'll look into it. You know, we'll do some research. I don't know that we're the best researchers on the planet, but we'll at least come up with something valid to talk about that issue. So, yeah, if you have something, let us know.
Did you see the mysterious giant sarcophagus discovered in Egypt?
No, I haven't heard about that one.
It's a giant black granite sarcophagus discovered in Alexandria, Egypt. This is according to the, you know, Egyptian Ministry of Antiquities, you know, yeah, that dude that you always see. The tomb, which dates back to the Ptolemaic period, that's 305 BC to 30 BC, was uncovered in the city of Alexandria. Now, in a Facebook post, the General Secretary of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities announced that the 6-foot-high sarcophagus, which is 8.7 feet long and 5.4 feet wide, is the largest ever found in Alexandria. It was buried 16.4 feet below the surface. A layer of mortar between the lid and the body of the sarcophagus indicates that it had not been opened since it was closed more than 2,000 years ago. Isn't that amazing?
Absolutely amazing.
Now, there was a carved head discovered at the site. It looks like kind of like a head, I guess. Archaeologists recently found a 2,200-year-old gold coin depicting the ancient King Ptolemy III, an ancestor of the famed Cleopatra. That's pretty cool. They recently found the world's oldest figurative tattoos on two ancient Egyptian mummies, one of which is the oldest tattooed female ever discovered. They found an ancient cemetery in Egypt with more than 40 mummies and a necklace containing a message from the afterlife, an ancient statue of a Nubian king with the inscription written in Egyptian hieroglyphics, also found at a West Nile temple in Sudan. They think they may have found the secret of the Great Pyramid's near-perfect alignment, and they're also confident that they have solved the long-standing mystery of the screaming mummy. There's a lot of mummy stuff going on.
There's a lot of mummy stuff, but there are a lot of mummies. Mummification been around for thousands of years. And there was a time when people thought that after you died, if they mummified your body, that you could come back and re-inhabit it at some time.
I'm not changing subjects, but I'm working this subject in because it kind of relates to this.
Okay.
The other day, I was listening to a presentation on near-death afterlife and reincarnation. And this gal was giving the presentation, and she got into it quite by accident. And it had to do with her son, at a young age, started talking all this stuff that he shouldn't know at this age.
Right.
It's not like he's going to pick up a book or have a video of it or see it on YouTube. I don't even think YouTube was there at the time when he was young. He was a black heavy artillery in the Civil War. So she's given this presentation on other reincarnation and stories of kids at a young age. They just start spouting this stuff. But it's all legitimate. They go and they look into what the child's saying and come to find there was a person this name and they did live in this part. It gets so creepy that a child who was supposedly this person gets to meet the person that died, their sister, who's a senior citizen now, but they, yeah, like actually meet. And the one kid, I think it was her son, had said, "You know what happens when you die, right? Tell me." "Well, you pick a belly and you do it again. You come back." So it got me to thinking, ouch. That was a joke. Maybe, you know, I have this fascination with ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
Maybe in a past life I had lived there. Maybe I was a pyramid construction worker or something. Does that make sense?
Maybe
if 10 generations ago I was an archaeologist that worked on it or something.
And I think it's hard to track these things down because, you know, we don't think much about past lives. But there's enough evidence that we have lived past lives to at least give some credibility to that idea that we can be reincarnated.
I didn't make you dumber by listening to what I just said, did I?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I've been this way all my life.
I'd like to get her on the show also to talk about her presentations and just the evidence that she has.
Because
she had a lot of just, you know, oh, here's another case where I had met this other, you know, this young lady. And she...
There's actually some books written about this. And if you look up anything written by Melvin Morse...
Mm-hmm.
M-E-L-V-I-N-M-O-R-S-E, Melvin Morse. He studied near-death experience and out-of-body experiences in young children. And he probably has, you know, 20 or 25, maybe even 30 years of research. and stories, you know, when he's interviewed kids. It's just fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating to read these stories and understand from the perspective of a child who hasn't had all these grown-up experiences. They haven't developed a greater sense of what is and isn't. So they're much more open to what is, even if we think it isn't. When I was, I had a friend who was talking to his daughter one day, his four-year-old daughter, and she was telling him about where she came from before she came to him, and about being out in the universe, and about all this kind of stuff about, you know, being in other lives. And he asked her, well, when you were there and you were going to come into our life, did you choose us or did we choose you? And she said, without hesitation, oh, I chose you. And from my understanding, I mean, that's kind of the way it is, that the spirit chooses the person rather than the person choosing the spirit.
So I chose my parents.
You chose them, yes. For whatever reason,
yeah.
You know, there was, as a spirit, there was something that your spirit wanted to learn, so it chose those parents and that moment to intervene in your life and become a part of you so that it could experience whatever you're going to experience in life. It doesn't mean that that spirit controls you or that your life is preordained. It just means that there's something about your circumstances that are going to, you know, possibly take you in a certain direction, and that spirit wants to experience that.
How do you think we would be as a society if we confirmed that reincarnation is real, that when you die, you come back, or you have a choice to come back, or there's an afterlife even, and then you get to come back, you get to pick? How do you think we would treat life as we experience it now?
Well, if you understand why we have a spirit and what our purpose is on Earth, I think it really would change the way we behave, because I think that human beings on this planet don't behave very well. They don't behave in a way that benefits them in the afterlife. And that's probably why we hear more about reincarnation, because I think there are more and more spirits that have to come back and try to learn the lessons again because they didn't learn the first time. And of course, it's living, loving, learning, and laughing. It's important that, number one, we love everybody. That doesn't mean we have to accept everybody, but we have to love other human beings and animals and all living things. That doesn't mean that, you know, we want to be friends with a bank robber. It just means that we can be understanding of that person. They still robbed a bank. They did something wrong. They have to go to court. They have to be convicted and punished and go through the process. It's not our job to change that for them, but it might be part of our job to help them to understand what they did wrong and why it's wrong. I mean, I know a lot of people who are not people that I really want to spend a lot of time with.
Easy, easy.
That means you. Yeah, yeah, you're the one. No. You're my friend. And my ugly stepchild. So. It's important that we have love in our heart, that we care about the people that are close to us, and that we don't develop hate for people who are different from us.
Well, people aren't going to do that, though.
Well, of course. It's human nature.
But let's say somehow they proved an afterlife is real, reincarnation happens. Do you think people would live more reckless than they do just knowing, oh, well, I'm coming back anyway, so...
No, I think they would live less recklessly.
You think so?
Yeah, because you want to, from the perspective of your spirit, in order for your spirit to grow, for you to continue on after this human body is dead and gone, and in order for you to continue on, just to have a consciousness beyond this life in this body, you have to learn and grow. You have to develop this sense of universal love and caring and understanding and learning. There's a growth process. Spirits have to grow too. They have to be born and raised and educated and trained. But they don't do it in schools. They do it in human bodies and animal bodies and trees and bodies of living beings on other planets, and then they also do it through observation in the universe. And their purpose is to help us to be better living material beings so that we can be better living spiritual beings. You can't live the spirit life on this planet. You have to live the human life. Humans are fallible. Humans are judgmental. Humans have a wide variety of emotions. Humans don't control themselves very well. And what we have to learn is to listen to the spirit, how to communicate with that spirit so that we can learn, so that we can be better people. The spirit doesn't control us. It's basically along for the ride, but it can, if we choose to listen to it, have influence over us. It can help us to change our path, to be on a better path. For any of you who have read my book, you'll understand that the path I was on was not necessarily the path I needed to be on.
Book? What and, book? What book are you talking about?
If Morning Never Comes by Bill Vandenbush. And if that path, the path that I was on that was not a functional path, if I had continued on that path, it would have been more destructive to my human life.
More destructive than it already was?
Yeah.
I mean, because your body was destroyed.
well, that's true, but it would continue the... I'm not talking about destroying the body as much as the mind, and the... You know, I may have done things that I shouldn't have done.
See how I set you up
for
that?
But when I talk about this path and about being destructive to myself, it's being destructive in a way that affects my ability to relate to other people. Let me think about how to put this.
You got to dumb it down for me?
No, but you know, again, I've talked about this before, that there aren't really words in the English language that are adequate to describe fully these spiritual experiences. So because of my near-death experience in 1969... and later, another encounter with the spirit, the early 80s, I was able to see and understand better how to make this communication, how to make this connection. And I changed paths. In my original path, I was working in the automotive industry, and I wanted to kind of continue that because it was something I knew. But by taking the time to connect with the spirit and listen to the spirit, I was able to change my career plans. I was able to embark upon a whole new journey that led to a great deal of personal satisfaction, some financial satisfaction, obviously working in the human services and helping people is not a way to get rich in this country. So, so I failed to get rich, but I got rich in many other ways because I got a great deal of personal satisfaction from the work that I did. And while that may not seem like an important thing, my spirit grew, and it continues to grow. And I know when I leave this planet that I will be a very advanced spirit. When I came to this planet, I was not. I was a very simple spirit, a young spirit. But when I leave, I will leave with a very old spirit. I will maintain more of my consciousness in the spirit world than I would have if I hadn't learned to make that connection, if I hadn't learned how to be kind and loving and caring and to reach out to other people. And I know some people think that that's a weakness, but I can guarantee you it's a strength. It takes a strong person to reach out and help other people.
Were you not nice to others and stuff like that?
No, I was always nice to people. I mean, I just from, you know, my early childhood, I was pretty nice to people, except maybe for my brother John, who I used to punch in the shoulder all the time. But, no, I mean, I've always had this sense of wanting to be kind to people. It's always been there, but I didn't always know how to do it in a way that was productive. By connecting with the spirit and being able to accept guidance from the spirit and actually to take a risk based on what I learned from the spirit, I was able to move forward in ways that I probably wouldn't have been otherwise. So I changed careers, I took on a new career, but I took the risk applying for jobs that I was absolutely unqualified for. And because I had taken other risks and done other things to help people, I actually got those jobs. When I got my first job as a counselor in a human service agency, I had nothing more than a degree in auto mechanics. I had no academic training. I had no experience. And yet they hired me.
So that's what's wrong with the system.
Yeah, that's it. But the Spirit said, go do this. Mm-hmm. This is where you need to go. And it helped me to find that path. You know, it didn't necessarily take me by the hand and walk me down the path, but it helped me to see what options were available and what opportunities were available and to take a risk. You know, there are certain times we want to take risks and certain times we don't. Robbing a bank is not the kind of risk you want to take.
Yeah.
Because there are serious consequences. But taking a risk of applying for a job or going to school or learning something new that you don't already know, those kind of risks lead to productivity. They lead to fulfillment, to fulfilling your own self and your dreams.
Well, that sounds like a bunch of New Age hooey.
It is. But it's hooey that works.
Hooey!
Yeah. I knew a guy that he wanted to be a musician. And he said, but I'm not a very good guitar player, and I'm not really a very good singer. And I said, but you don't have to be. You don't have to be the best. All you have to do is do it. And you have to do it over and over again, and you have to put yourself in front of the right audience. Well, he did that. And he never became a great guitar player, and he never became a great singer. But he did cut a number of albums and gained some popularity enough to where he could make a living, a good living,
mm-hmm.
with his music, and what he loved doing.
And that guy was Mick Jagger.
Jagger, right. Was Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
So, no, it was, I won't tell you who it was because...
Oh, yeah.
That's a
we don't want to...
Confidential issue.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that people who follow their dreams, people who do what they love rather than what makes a lot of money, are much more successful, happy, self-fulfilled. And that's what it's all about.
Here's a prime example. My dad wanted me to be a longshoreman like him and tried to open doors for me, but I just didn't want anything to do with it.
Right.
They make decent money, insurance coverage and things. And
they have a union.
Yeah, and I went, well, where I'm at. Not rich,
but
you know, I went where my passion was instead of where the money was.
Right. You're doing what you love, and you're influencing people and helping people to have a better life. When I listen to you in the morning...
I'm sorry.
I know. It's hard, but I do listen sometimes. When I listen to you in the morning and I hear the music that you play,
mm-hmm.
and I hear the things that you say, it influences how I feel.
Yeah.
Music is a very, very powerful tool. We can use it to feel good. We can use it to feel bad. And sometimes we can feel good and bad all within the same song.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I learned in becoming a public speaker was if I can get people to laugh and cry in the same speech, I've been very successful because I've touched their emotions. I've made them think about themselves. I've made them think about how they feel and what they want to do with those feelings. And that's really important, how we feel and how people make us feel, you know. And like I said, you don't have to like everybody. You don't have to fall in with people that you don't like. If you don't like somebody, avoid them. But if you like people, embrace them.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. If you would like to listen to our back episodes, our back nonsense, other strange topics, or contact Bill and yell at him, all that good stuff, log on to strangeharbor.net. We'll be back next Sunday, 4 p.m., right here on KBKW.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.